before I get to the questions here, I really do want to touch on these two because they're so important, and I'll try to do it as quickly as we can. On Iran, president's concerned about it, Israel's concerned about it, world community is concerned about it. What exactly is the threat from Iran, and how likely is it that we may have a military confrontation sometime in the near future?
Well, the threat of the nuclear weapon, weapons plural, is a horrible threat. And our president has indicated, and I think many members of Congress, that this is unacceptable. We've worked with Israeli officials, and who could speak to this, to indicate that some unilateral activity by Israel would not be efficient, largely because we believe that a lot of the nuclear program is buried in ways that are going to be beyond an initial first strike or even a second strike or what have you. This is going to be a very tough military operation if you were to go at it hammer and tongs to root it all out. So it seems to me that what we really need to be having now, so that we have some credibility, is a discussion with the American public. And this is very difficult to do in a war-weary situation. But the president, the Secretary of Defense, others who are knowledgeable about this, are going to have to describe how you eradicate the Iranian problem. By that I mean aircraft flights or cyber warfare or all sorts of things that may be involved, and what the cost of this is likely to be in dollars and the risk to American lives, so that we all understand, and so the Iranians understand, that we are serious. We're really thinking about this. If it's necessary to come to that decision, everybody sort of is aboard and knows what is involved. And I think this is especially critical. I would add, however, in the meanwhile, that all of the election now has 8 candidates running, all of whom are trying to exceed each other in telling how much they need the nuclear business and to impress the Ayatollah. So not going to be much of debate there. There are young people in Iran also. I'm not saying we can wean them all away, but I was surprised the other day to find out that we were not allowing iPhones and other apparatus to be sold to people in Iran. I thought, oh my goodness, what kind of a world do you think you're living in? This is a situation in which we really got to get some information to a lot of people who likewise in their country want to see a future and may not feel with the old guys, the Ayatollah and the people running for president now, that they're any more representative than they saw Mubarak or Saddam Hussein or what have you. In other words, in our own Arab Spring efforts, it seems to me we have to be realistic in terms of the sacrifice, but we also better get information to people in every way we can. And there are a lot of ways to do that in the modern world that were not available even 3, 4, or 5 years ago, with the thought that public opinion in Iran may not overthrow the Ayatollah, but at least to mitigate the situation. As we hear reports from Iran now, the public as a whole seems to be in favor of going ahead with the nuclear program. And even though they're hurting in terms of their currency and maybe less food and less retail and so forth, they're a patriotic surge in this direction. And so this is going to require something beyond simply every 3 or 4 months saying it's unacceptable and saying there's a red line or something of this variety. This won't go over well with the American public anymore. They don't really believe it. Quite apart from the Iranians.
Ehud, quickly.
I think that nuclear Iran will be a terrible development. It will put an end to any conceivable non-proliferation regime. It will be the end of the story. I vividly remember sitting down with Bill Casey on Pakistan and then with President Clinton on North Korea. They both turned nuclear. So whoever said it cannot happen, it can happen, but it will be the end of it. They will sponsor terror. They will be strengthened vis-a-vis the Sunnites. It is a nightmare for the moderate Arabs. And there is a paradox in the Arab world. In the moderate Arab world, the leaders are pro-Americans and the public hates America. In Iran, the regime is extremely anti-American. The public likes America. It's not a secret. So it's basically, but the public is not strong enough. And what they really try to achieve is not just what I used to describe as physical protection, immunity for their nuclear problem by burying it deep enough in the ground. What they ultimately trying to achieve is the kind of political immunity that they believe both Pakistan and North Korea achieved through being nuclear. No one will dare. Look what happened in Syria, and try to imagine what would have happened if Syria would have turned nuclear. Ask yourself whether Kuwait would have been liberated if Saddam could argue that he has a few crude nuclear devices. It won't never happen. So I used to scorn American colleagues, and Leon well remember it, that when we talk about surgical operation, we think about scalpels. And you Americans, you are thinking about chisel and 10-pound hammer. But I should admit that in the recent few years, where Leon was extremely, I know that you missed him and Sylvia missed him here, but he was very effective in Washington. So under the president and himself, America developed extremely subtle, impressive scalpels. So nowadays, the whole this vision of having in to deal with Iran physically, if worse come to worst, we of course all prefer diplomacy or other secret means. But if worse come to worst and something should be done, it is not anymore Owen Shock in the skies of Baghdad that will stretch for another 10 years with undecided war. It is something that might end up with a fraction of one night and with technically the Iranians. And if you look at the technicalities, they can't do a lot about it, even afterwards. The most they can do is to attack Israel and argue that Israel was part of the collusion or whatever. Probably Israel will part it or lead it. I don't know if worse come to worse. But having said that, we have to bear in mind that being so limited, it's in a way on the spectrum from a war on Iraq or a war in Afghanistan, and on the other end of the spectrum, the raid on bin Laden. It gradually, the hand shows more and more closely to the raid than to the full-scale war. So I don't believe in this vision of the whole world collapsing in front of our eyes just because either Israel or America decided there's no other way to stop it physically. Basically, all kind of consequences already happened. We have South Africa and Libya that were convinced to leave it. Mm-hmm. We had the North Korean and Pakistanis that achieved it. And we had Iraq and Syria that were stopped. All end games could end. But when you think, when you are warned by people, some of the great veterans, Jim Baker or others, I don't know, Scowcroft or Powell or Brzezinski, warn you that it's going to be a disaster, I tell you, to the best of my judgment, if you will have, or we will have as a collective, to deal with a nuclear Iran several years down the stream, because this will be the inevitable result of inaction, it will be much more complicated, much more dangerous, much more costly in human lives and in financial resources, and with much far-reaching unintended consequences.
Let me just
Joe, just quick.
See, I believe that the American people understand this, or a majority of them do, that this is something different. Notwithstanding all the talk about war weariness, we're not talking here about asking the president as commander-in-chief to order a massive ground invasion of Iran to disable their nuclear weapons program. We're talking about America using the extraordinary military power it has, greater than Israel's power, to disable this threat to the stability of the region, to our security as well, because of the strength and support that Iran gives to terrorists. So,
Joe, let me ask you, do you think we're going to reach that point in the near future?
I do, for this reason. We have applied the most tough economic sanctions against Iran that we have ever against any other country. And they've hurt a lot of Iranian people in the Iranian economy, but they have not affected the single decision maker, Ayatollah Khamenei. And I believe, just watching him, reading what he says and what people around him say, that he has decided that, if you will, he sees himself in history. Ayatollah Khomeini, created the revolution. Khamenei, has the opportunity to perpetuate the revolution, and the one way to do that is by having Iran become a nuclear power. And therefore, I think it's really up to him. But everything I say says to me that the Iranians are not going to stop their nuclear weapons program short of military action by us or the Israelis. I think we're much better prepared to do it. Our Arab allies are urging us to do it. We ought to do it. In my opinion, this is the most significant foreign policy decision President Obama will make in the 8 years as president, maybe the most significant decision, and it will affect the future. If we can stop Iran's nuclear weapons program, the stability and security and peace and freedom of the region and the world are dramatically improved. If they go nuclear, our future is going to be a lot less safe and prosperous than it should be.
All right. I apologize to the audience, but I've got to touch on this other issue before I get to the questions. Syria. Syria, we know, is a human disaster. We almost have close to 100,000 people who have died there, refugees pouring into Jordan and Turkey, chaotic situation with Assad combining with Iran, combining with Hezbollah on one side. We have the opposition on the other side with elements of al-Qaeda in what's called the al-Nusra Front that are involved. We now have, the president had drawn a red line with regards to the use of chemical weapons. It appears, at least by the French and the British and others, that they may well have crossed that line with regards to chemical usage. What should the United States do? Should the United States get involved, aid the opposition? I mean, that's a decision that the White House is confronting this week. What should they do? What should we do?
Well, I believe, and I've talked before about why I think so much is on the line in Syria, the stability of the whole region, the Sunni-Shia conflict, genocide that's occurring there, and the message that's going out from what we're doing in Syria, or really more to the point, what we're not doing to Tehran, which encourages them to go on with their nuclear weapons program. There's an international coalition waiting to be built against Assad. It's not going to be certified by the United Nations because Russia and China won't let it happen. But I believe Britain, France, and maybe some others in Europe will join us. It's very clear that our allies in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates will join us. Probably Turkey will as well. I think we have to take strong action now. I think we have to, and we have the capacity to do this again without putting troops on the ground, either from the air or by firing missiles from offshore, which we have the ability to do. We can knock out the Syrian Air Force on the ground. We can crater some of the airfields that they have to use to take off. And if that, and I'd really consider hitting some strategic buildings in Syria, the kind that house, let's put elements of Assad's regime, to show him and the Iranians that we mean business. I hope this goes to some kind of negotiated settlement. But remember, the Bosnian War was ended in the negotiations in Dayton, Ohio, only after President Clinton ordered very strong military action against the Serbs. Right now, there's no incentive for Assad or the Iranians to compromise.
Dick, you agree with that?
No, and I would just say reluctantly that, yes, you know, I would like to agree because the suffering, the number of people killed, the monstrous loss of life and so forth, it just impels people to be concerned about this. The dilemma, however, as I see it, is that the Alawites, and that includes the Assad government that's dependent upon them, are a very small minority of the population in Syria. It just appears to me that when you have minority governments of that sort of minority populations who are involved in the crossfire now with the Sunni-Shiite business, that they're going to fight until they die, until they literally are almost exterminated. So our thought that somehow by taking action, some reasonable rationality will take hold, and people then will begin to negotiate, try to think through some type of government with a few Sunnis and a few here, there, and yon, and so forth, is totally unrealistic with regard to Syria. And it just appears to me that for the time being, that President Obama's caution has been the proper course, simply because we as a country are not prepared to police Syria for a 10-year period of time. We're really not prepared to try to separate all the different strains of the Shiite religion or the Arabs coming in with the Sunnis or all the rest of it. We don't understand it as maybe the administration does, but certainly Congress, on my judgment, did not, in terms of all the briefings and debates that we had behind closed doors. We're just beginning to understand Syria, quite apart from deciding who to arm and who might coalesce and who might do this or that. The fact is the Syrians find this to be impossible. Even as we speak, they're meeting and they're trying to decide, are there a certain number of coalition groups? And then finally saying, well, there really aren't, and so if you won't give us arms, we won't even come to the table with the Russians and yourselves. So we have some distance to go on this, and it seems to me that the caution is proper, even though the losses are substantial. As I said, we have seen losses in Iraq, in which we dealt with people for 10 years, and they're going on right now. And so the fact that we intervene, even with no boots on the ground and all this sort of thing, that may have worked with 6 million people in Libya, but it will not work in the cross currents of Syria.
Ehud, we now have Hezbollah getting much more deeply involved. The opposition is attacking Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's gotten very close to the Golan Heights. Is it likely that this is going to result in a larger confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon?
I hope not, and we should impose upon ourselves certain self-discipline not to, to let it happen. I think that more probable than the scenario that Joe described at the beginning of the evening about a wider regional conflict, a fighting conflict between all the Sunnites against all the Shiites, it's more probable that before then we'll find ourselves somehow involved in at least the triangle of Syria and Lebanon ourselves, because it's an easy way to try to draw the attention from the real story by announcing that Israel is the real enemy. I think that if we leave aside for a moment the tempting idea of, probably tempting to some, of letting them bleed for a long time, which I think it's improper facing the human consequences. There are only two ways, either to enter with whatever depth and means it will take until it's quiet, and in this regard, Dick is right. You cannot start there, and then you find along the way that you need the boots on the ground in order to reach certain results. But it's either to decide it or to look for a reconciliation. And I think that before you go for an active, full-scale operation beyond supplying the rebels with weapons, which I feel a way could be found to do it without too much fanfare, I know. But it's worth trying to put an end to it diplomatically. And the only way to do this is by applying to the Russian, which Kerry tried, did not succeed at this point, but I'm not convinced that it's over. To come to the Russian, tell them, please lead. We will. The European led in Libya, America led from behind, and Russia still feels that they were manipulated and dragged into it. Now we give you an opportunity. Lead. We respect your spatial role in Russia. The Kremlin invested huge amount of political capital, financial resources, whatever prestige, in supporting the Assad family for two generations now. Lead. They are the only ones who can put an end to it, probably without accepting the precondition of removing Assad before the negotiations start, but they are realistic. They understand that Assad is doomed. They cannot afford deserting him before the negotiations started. And they are keeping in mind the need to protect the 2 million Alawites, which are about 10%, and might be slaughtered if it's let wild. So basically the Russians, even we worry a lot about the chemical warfare. I can tell you the Russians know, the commanders of all these chemical warfare units, on first name basis. They were students in their academies and postgraduate or whatever. In Moscow, I mean, not here. And they are the only ones who can do it. And there could be a wider deal here. If they are allowed to play the leading role, understanding they probably will keep their ports in Tartus and Latakia and so, some role in the post-Assad Syria, you can then expect them to help to solve or to be quiet about the need to solve Iran. Because what I'm worried as a Middle Eastern leader is that the attention that will be drawn immediately, because it seems more urgent, into Syria will end with the energy that the world can allocate to anything in the Middle East, and it will be at the expense of dealing with the real challenge, much more far kind of reaching, with much more far-reaching consequences of Iran. And I don't want a struggle in Syria to paralyze the world from doing the right thing, and we don't have all the time in the world for Iran.
All right. I'm going to try to get through some questions here. We've got a little bit of time. If you could just keep your answers as short as possible.
You've got a problem.
I mean, in the House, we talk for 5 minutes.
Yeah, I know. You've got a problem. You've got three people out of office, and we love to have an audience.
Does Israel need to abandon West Bank settlements before peace in the Middle East can be achieved?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's not really relevant. I was the closest one to reach a peace with the Palestinians. And at my time as a prime minister, we were building in the settlement 4 times the pace that Netanyahu is building now. Ehud Olmert, after me, I was his minister of defense. He came very close with Bush Jr. and in Annapolis. And we were building 2x the pace we're building now. So it ends up that Netanyahu's government is not building very kind of in a feverish manner. Beyond this, as Dick mentioned, if we delineate a line around which that will end up being a border or very close to the border, whatever we built within future Israel doesn't matter for the Palestinians. Whatever we built on their side, they can take it as a gift. It's like that cannot stop, that cannot be a justification to put an end to negotiation. And bear in mind, after 46 years of building, with almost 350, probably close to 400 Israelis living behind the old borders, the whole settlements together doesn't cover even 2%, 2% of the area of the West Bank. So to argue that these settlements are blocking the hopes, the aspirations of the Palestinians for a state has nothing to do with reality, just propaganda. I believe that if they will have the, as Arafat used to say, if there is a will, there is a way, but there is no will on the Palestinian side to complete it.
You agree with that?
Yes.
Joe?
We used to answer to Arafat, I should that. On the Israeli side, when Arafat said, if there is a will, there is a way, our guy used to, legal advisor used to answer, in the Jewish tradition, if there is a will, there are relatives.
uh, How is social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, aiding or hindering the various revolutions in the Middle East? Dick?
Well, clearly the young people, and some people not so young, began to understand how to utilize all this. It was very important, I believe, in Tunisia and in Egypt. But having said that, everybody informed each other, and it didn't make a difference. One time came, and the Muslim Brotherhood had the votes, had the ability to organize the government. So the young people are still twittering back and forth, but they are not, as a matter of fact, running the government. I made the suggestion earlier, however, that in the case of the Iranian young people, they need at least to have the opportunity to have a go at it. There has to be some undercurrent going on there, some of the foment that occurred in Egypt and Tunisia. Now, the State Department got some things underway last time before the Iranian elections. A young guy named Jared Cohen I knew in the State Department, and I recommended him to Secretary Rice, and he got a job, and he had some other people working with him. And they got a lot of information into Iran. We got a lot of information out of Iran. When things were going on in the streets, we were on our computers able to see really what was going on. I'm sad that this sort of died out for a while, and that's why I'm making such a point of it tonight. The social media offers huge opportunities in North Korea. When I was over there in Seoul 2 weeks ago, I tried to make that point again and again. That this is not a situation that's blocked off. You can't do it anymore in this world. We've got to be ingenious enough as Americans to get the message out. It may be a garbled message, it may be young expressions that are not very sage-like, but I would take a hope that, as a matter of fact, just getting the information, getting the ferment going is tremendously important.
I want to share a story with you on this point. Obviously, revolutions occurred before the social media came along, as the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and I hate to mention the same breath, but the Bolshevik Revolution. But social media have played an important role here, and just this is the story. When McCain and I went to Tunisia after the uprising, the American ambassador hosted a meeting for us with the leaders of the Tunisian Revolution. We had a very good discussion about what we could do to help. At the end, one of the young men got up and said, "Senators, there's a particular American we would want more than any other to come and visit our country." So I was thinking, who's he going to say? President Obama, Secretary Clinton? Mark Zuckerberg. Because they felt that Zuckerberg gave them the weapons with which they carried out this really miraculous revolution.
Let me, just building on that, if I could, in the remaining time, ask you about, obviously, what's making the news today. The revelation that that obviously, in order to go after terrorists, we've been, the NSA has been using the numbers, going after numbers used in telephone calls to determine who's connecting with terrorists. And the president supported that. And there are a lot of concerns that have been raised about that. This whole issue of balancing our security needs and our freedoms, that's what America is all about. Give me your sense of whether, you know, what, for, and you've dealt with security issues, Joe. Do you think that the United States, you know, has been doing the right thing with regards to this area?
I do. And look, this is a classic moment, security, liberty. I care about both, obviously. During my time in the Senate, I was briefed on both of the programs that have become controversial now. And let me just start by saying that I believe civil liberties and privacy have been very well protected in what's going on. I want to give a different kind of reaction that I had when I learned about these capabilities that NSA has, which is to say, thank God a branch of the American government has the ability technologically to do things that were unbelievable a short time ago to protect us from this unconventional enemy we're facing now that strikes us in the shadows. They don't come at us in airplanes or in fixed movement of ground troops. And the ability to find patterns in phone calls or email communication and then to sort of pursue them overseas, I think is critically important to our security. So I understand the reaction of some people, but we would, each one of us, well, let me just put it this way. Each one of us would be in potentially a lot more danger in terms of our safety, our well-being, even our lives, than the risk, which I think is non-existent, to our privacy and civil liberties as a result of these programs.
Dick?
I agree with Joe, and I thought the president in his press conference in California outlined this in some detail, pretty explicitly and carefully, that he was very much in favor of civil liberties, as we all are, and we're protective and when we're in public service and doing that. But at the same time, this particular operation simply counted the number of times callers counted with the other. They're not the content or the invasion of the privacy of the message or whatever was said, but it was just to see if there are patterns that might show some particular organization in the United States at work, and then giving the algorithms that might be applied these days, giving us some focal point for our intelligence services to work.
Ehud, you have to face some of these same issues in Israel.
We face the same issues for a long time. I believe we have the equivalent of the same law. I believe that it works well. It protects the public as long as it is a law, not just a caprice of one branch. The executive branch operates with the full knowledge and exposure to the proper committees. The Congress, in your case, in our case, is the Knesset. The proper subcommittees are fully aware, can ask whatever they feel proper. And there is a judge, an independent judge, the judiciary branch approve any kind of step. So in Israel, there is, beyond this, the state controller who digs into each of the other three to make sure that they acting properly. So within this cooperation, it is justifiable, and I want to kind of reduce the enthusiasm about it. When you deal with the modern algorithms and with the modern equipment, it's not about listening to what any individual citizen told anyone else, he or she. It's about following the mass movements. The more massive it is, the less personal it is. It's just moving, not even the individual numbers, but it's not just help to intercept terrorist acts before they happen and save lives. It helps dramatically. It's an extremely powerful tool to analyze in retrospect after we failed to intercept certain event, and it caused the certain sometimes fatal casualties. You can look backward and study all the patterns of behavior, the connections, the sources of the next hit, and it becomes extremely, extremely effective. I think that, of course, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, as already been said. It should be within certain transparency, internal transparency of processes. But it's essential for secure the lives of modern democracy citizens.
No, it's a, you know, this is obviously, it's a debate that the United States should have, you know, in determining the balance between security, our security needs, and our freedoms. You know, in my experience, my responsibility at CIA and as Secretary of Defense, my first responsibility was to protect this country and to save lives. We wanted to make sure that 9/11 never happens again in this country. And the way we did that was obviously through laws passed by the Congress that provided authorities. We had to brief the Congress, had to brief the intelligence committees as to all of our operations. They were fully aware of those operations. And in the end, these operations were extremely important in going after Al-Qaeda and those that threaten this country. And ultimately, you know, we do have to protect this country because freedom is not free. Freedom can only be exercised when we are secure. And so we need to have this debate. It's an important one to have, but let us also understand the responsibility that we protect our country in this process. Listen, I want to thank all three of you. This has been an outstanding debate. Thank you. Thank you.